I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Dozens of Minnesotans are saying they're lucky to be alive today. We reached Matt Lundquist, one of those stuck in rush hour traffic on the Highway 35 bridge just entering the city of Minneapolis when huge bridge sections began to fall to the ground and to the Mississippi River below, slab by slab.
I was on the north end, and then I felt a big jolt, and that's when I saw everything in front of me just disappear. And then I felt another jolt, and I think that was the section behind me slamming down. So then I looked in my rearview mirror. I didn't see anything, and then a cloud of dust came up. And, you know, I just was waiting for my section to collapse too, and it didn't. And so I opened my door after about 10 seconds and walked away.
What happened then? I mean, were people getting out of the cars that had fallen? What did you see?
Yeah, you know, some of the windshields were blown out, and I saw one gal. She was doing all right, and she was getting out of her car as I was walking down, and she was shaking up. And I did see one guy on the ground, and there wasn't an overhead danger. So I just told him to hang tight. He was complaining about how bad his back hurt, and he was a little bit bloody. Mm-hmm. And everybody else in my area was able to walk away, which was amazing. They must have rolled over, you know, not too violently, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm extremely lucky.
Well, Matt, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay. Thanks, Robin.
That's Matt Lundquist, as we said, on the bridge last night, and lucky, as he said, to be speaking to us today. As many as 30 people are still missing following that collapse of the span almost 2,000 feet long. Chief Timothy Dolan of the Minneapolis Police Department told reporters at a news conference today that recovery crews expect to be on the scene for at least the next 3 days.
We know that there are numerous other vehicles that are in the water, and so the recovery involving those vehicles and people who may be in those vehicles is going to take a long time.
We are going to be speaking to several engineers and have a conversation about bridges across the country. But first, we want the latest in Minneapolis, and we turn to Jack Rice, who's a reporter with WCCO CBS Radio in Minneapolis. And Jack, what's happening at the scene there right now?
Well, there was a time when they were dealing with search and rescue. Now, sadly, they're dealing with recovery. At this point, there are 4 confirmed dead, but there are more than 30 people that are missing. We also have 79 injured. The difficulty that they're facing right now, according to some of the sources that we have, is that the current is so strong, things are so unstable, they're having a very, very hard time getting into the water. But they have counted at least 30, maybe 40, maybe even up to 50 cars that are under the Mississippi.
Hmm. Late this morning, federal and state officials briefed reporters. What did they say about the investigation? How long might it take?
Well, they admit that it's going to take a minimum of 3 days that they're going to deal with. Just dealing with the scene itself, the investigation may take much, much longer. They have already ruled out a question of terrorism. They have gone beyond that, though, and they're looking for deficiencies, for fatigue in the bridge itself. Understand, this is a 1,900-foot span over the Mississippi River. It's a very, very large bridge. I think when you see pictures on TV, it truly doesn't do it justice. It's an 8-lane major interstate thoroughfare, and so when this thing collapsed, I was on the Mississippi River this morning looking at this very scene, and it's momentous. It truly is.
I would imagine, I mean, I have been over the bridge and jogged underneath it. There's a huge complexes, parks underneath it, and then the river and the river travel itself. You've got the football, baseball stadium on one side, University of Minnesota on the other. I mean, this is a pivotal artery.
It truly is. When you look at about 2.5 million people live in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. There are 2 major sets of bridges. There's one slightly to the west, and then there is this one. With about 100,000, maybe up to 200,000 people a day back and forth across this bridge, you realize how significant it is. Now, I've talked with some people at MnDOT, the Minnesota Department of Transportation. They said they will replace this bridge, but this could take up to 2 years.
Well, the bridge was inspected by the state in 2005 and 6. No immediate structural problems were found. A federal study in 2005 rated this 40-year-old bridge structurally deficient. They also found fatigue cracking. We're going to talk to an engineer in a moment, but what did officials say about that designation of structurally deficient?
I think there are a lot of people asking a lot of questions, because we can take you all the way back to 2001 when there was an additional report where they talked about fatigue and that there may be serious deficiencies back then. Now we look at the 2005 and the 2006 questions. Additional fatigue here. Certainly we have a lot more than that, and people will be asking a lot of questions. And what makes this a national story, not just a local one, besides the tragedy of it, is that there are a lot of truss bridges across the country, and a lot of them are about this this age. So if there was a problem here in Minneapolis, that very same problem could face every other major city in the country.
We'll talk more about just what a truss bridge is, but I got one last question for you. We know there were at least 18, maybe 20 construction workers on the bridge putting down concrete finish in a routine resurfacing project. We understand they'd been working this week on the bridge's joints and guardrails. Eyewitnesses who survived talked of suddenly seeing these workers surrealistically suspended in midair, you know, before they fell. We've been talking about the drivers and the cars. Have the workers been accounted for?
There were apparently 18 workers on the scene at the time, and they were doing a lot of resurfacing, really maintenance rather than construction work. It wasn't dealing with the actual structure of this 35W bridge. Of those 18, 17 have been accounted for. About four of them were injured, apparently, but sadly, there is one of those workers who is still missing.
Jack Rice, reporter with WCCO CBS Radio in Minneapolis. Jack, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
Well, joining us now is Richard Staley. He works in St. Paul, Minnesota, at the American Engineer Testing Company, which is based there. Bridges are among his specialties. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, good morning.
And we want to rush to say you have not inspected or worked on this bridge, correct?
No, I haven't.
Right. So, maybe you can talk about it from being there in the Minnesota area, being so familiar with it and watching it as an engineer. This bridge, as we were just saying, was rated as structurally deficient. I just want to read you what some officials have said. Jim Burnett, who's the former chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, who happened to be in Minnesota last night, said a structurally deficient bridge might mean not adequate for the traffic it takes, but not necessarily dangerous. Although he added, a lot of structurally deficient bridges are dangerous, so that's confusing to us. What does that mean to you when you heard this bridge had been rated structurally deficient?
Well, there's some things about the bridge that are not desirable, and it could be still serviceable if certain actions are taken. And this bridge was inspected, I believe, in 2004 and also in 2006, and the inspections indicated it was safe to be used. Obviously, the system didn't prevent this this tragedy, and we need to look at our systems and find out why they're letting us down.
Right, right. And we're going to talk more about that. And again, this is not a bridge that you worked on, but you certainly know bridges and concrete. As Jack said, this is raising questions across the country. This is a statistic from the American Society of Civil Engineers. As of 2005, 156,335 of the nation's 595,363 bridges, maybe, 26%, more than a quarter, were structurally deficient as compared to all the bridges in 1992. Does that strike you as a high number?
Given the age and the number of bridges we have, I don't see that as being alarming, but we need to maintain these bridges if we're going to use them, and we're spending about $7 billion a year replacement costs, and that probably isn't enough to address all the needs that we have.
Well, let's talk about what kind of a bridge it is, because it is very alarming to you know, I'm sure many people that many would be considered structurally deficient, even though that, as you said, doesn't mean total failure. This was a 40-year-old truss bridge. Tell us, first of all, what is truss bridge? And also, one civil engineering professor said some of the early truss bridges didn't have as many structural redundancies as newer ones. So, translate, what is a truss and what's a redundancy?
Well, let's start at the ground. There's a concrete pier that supports the bridge on either end. It spans about 450 feet across the river. Mm-hmm. And on the north side, the piers are right at the river level, and on the south side, they're up a hill, both probably founded on sandstone, which is some of the bedrock in our area.
When you say piers, you mean those
concrete
poles?
Yeah, these are the foundation or support which the superstructure is going to rest on. Mm-hmm. Then as you come up off the concrete, it's structural steel. And you have an arch that's made up of a truss that spans all the way across the river, spanning about 450 feet.
Right. We understand it's so that you can keep the river traffic going. The span is used in the middle of the bridge.
Yes, there is a lock and dam underneath it. Mm-hmm. And this driving surface is probably 80 feet or so or 90 feet above the water, on that order.
Right.
And then on the top, there's another set of girders, steel girders, that bear on the arch, and then there's a concrete deck that is resting on the girders underneath.
Now, what is the redundancy?
Well, there's just a single span, and so if you should lose support of the foundation for the single span, or if you should have a break in one of the members in the single span, you could have a total collapse.
Right. Yeah. Well, and as we said, one civil engineering professor says these early truss bridges don't have as many of these backups as the newer ones do. How concerned are engineers about that?
Well, they certainly are, but this is in place. It's 40 years old. You design them to last about 70 years, and you maintain them so they do indeed last that long without any difficulty.
Well, let me ask you about that, because we've been hearing reports, and at least one of our listeners wrote and asked that they'd heard a TV report that bridges are built to last 25 to 40 years, and they gagged when they heard that because it seems like the warranty would be running out on a lot of the nation's bridges.
That's much too short a time period for that kind of investment.
Yeah, but even 75, I mean, I think that would come as a surprise to some people.
Well, you'd like them to last longer, and indeed many of them do, and if you check them and you evaluate them, they could continue to serve the public. But the designer at the beginning looks at it and says, I'm going to try and make this last, I will make this last, and design it to last 70 years. Now, the deck that is we're driving on is not intended to last 70 years, and that's why maintenance was going on the surface.
Right.
We often will patch the concrete and repair the concrete, and the contractor had done this, and it had been done 10 years before. They were in the process of putting on an overlay. There's a 2-inch overlay that goes on after the patching, and that's what the contractor was doing at the time. They were in the process, and the missing worker was one of the buggy operators that was hauling concrete to the laydown operation.
The workers that lived said they just rode the thing down as it fell. Well, as an engineer, you've already said we need to spend more money, and we're going to be talking more about that in a couple minutes after the break. But what else are some of the problems? I mean, I'm wondering, 100,000 cars use this bridge every day. I'm sure 20, 30 years after these bridges were built, the traffic on them is double what it once was.
Well, and people would like to have heavier vehicles, heavier trucks use them, and the designs really don't accommodate that. But in this particular design, what's perhaps a little more troubling about this 1967 age bridge is that we have known that this type of design is prone to a fatigue type of problem. The details of the metal and how it's the shapes of the metal and stiffeners and things like that are prone to developing fatigue cracking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that goes undetected and unchecked, it can lead to a failure of a member and then ultimately to the failure of the bridge.
Well, Richard Staley, as we have just heard, Jim Burnett, former Transportation Board Chair, says that, in fact, the 2005 federal study found the fatigue cracking in the bridge, so we're sure they're going to be continuing to look at that. Richard's been talking to us from his office. He's principal at American Engineer Testing. Richard, thank you so much for weighing in with us today. And thank you.
You're welcome.
And we want to continue to take a look at not just Minneapolis, but America's bridges. They're the veins and arteries that carry us across the country. We'll have much more after a quick break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. John Joachim was on his way to the Twins baseball game when the Highway 35 bridge collapsed in Minneapolis last night. We reached him, and he told us what he saw.
To get to the stadium, you cross that bridge, and you get off at the exit directly across from it.
Right.
And you're right downtown. Probably about 150, 200 yards before the bridge, you know, the traffic slowed down to a stop. We looked up ahead, and you could see a dust cloud sort of forming. Now, we all knew they were doing construction on the bridge, so you know, we thought it was something related to that. And then the cloud just grew in size. It became enormous and sort of just wafted over the whole area. And then they flashed a message on the traffic sign that said, incident at River Bridge, lane closed. Well, the understatement of the year, I think.
Yeah.
People started getting out of their cars, and we didn't really understand what happened. We just assumed there was a bad accident of some kind. I don't think any of us really realized the bridge had collapsed. I couldn't see the actual collapse myself.
When you say you left your car, were you on the road?
I was on the interstate. I mean, everybody was getting out and sort of looking around. And some people started backing up on the interstate and getting off at the exit before the bridge. And actually, the Twins game continued last night, which people thought, why could they play a baseball game? But there were about 25,000 people there, and they said to cancel the game and send all those people out into the street, literally about five blocks from that bridge would have just been overwhelming to have all that traffic clogging
right.
streets at the time when they had to have emergency vehicles going. So they played the game, but today's game is canceled.
What's going on there today? What's the mood there today?
It's pretty somber. You know, we're a small town. I mean, we're a metropolitan area. There's about 2.5 million people in the Twin Cities, but it's still a small town feel, and everybody knows everybody. People are all wondering if they knew somebody was there, and most everybody in the area has gone across that bridge at one time or another. It's close to the University of Minnesota, where I attended school, and I went across that bridge almost every day.
Hmm.
So it's the major road in our state, and now it's gone.
Well, John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
John Joachim in Minneapolis. Thomas Rooney joins us now. He's an expert on infrastructure, president of In Situ Form Technologies in St. Louis, Missouri, although he's speaking to us from Kuala Lumpur, where he's on a project. Tom, first of all, welcome back. And could you put this in context for us? As tragic as last night's accident was, what does it represent?
Well, Robin, what it represents is really, as you say, a very tragic event, but the fact of the matter is there are bridges that collapse around the United States every week.
In fact, you told us what? You told us one on average a week.
Right. Small bridges somewhere in the United States, about one a week, and most don't get much claim. You know, it's kind of analogous to steam pipes. We don't talk about steam pipes exploding until one erupts in Manhattan or a levee fails in New Orleans. I mean, it takes the most tragic example of something that happens frequently before we all talk about it.
Well, and last we spoke with you, we were speaking about the poor state of sewage infrastructures. And as you said, we had the steam pipe explosion in Manhattan. Here in New England, sewer grates have been blowing off a major highway, hitting cars. And
right.
it's not just old construction. We should say we're in Boston. Our brand new Ted Williams Tunnel collapsed, portion collapsed. A woman was killed because of poor epoxy used in bolting panels.
Right.
But I mean, again, some would say, well, but there's millions of bridges and tunnels and there's only these few accidents. Or what? Is there an alarm that's being raised?
Well, yeah, there should be an alarm raised. And we shouldn't just look at individual bridges, as catastrophic as they are, and refer to them as accidents, when really what we're talking about is, you know, as you had pointed out, 160-some-odd thousand out of 595,000, 25% of our bridges are deficient in some fashion, and as was mentioned by Richard Staley, deeply need maintenance that isn't going on.
Well, what's the problem?
You put those two together.
Well, what's the problem? Why isn't the money going to it?
It's political will, and politicians around the world just don't get elected to put money into old things. They should, but they don't. Politics being what they are, a person in America just isn't going to get elected mayor by saying, I'm going to pour lots of money into an old bridge, when everybody says, you know, I drove across that bridge, my father drove across that bridge. But it really is the responsibility of the politician to say that, you know, those water mains and those sewer pipes and those steam pipes and bridges have to be maintained. And
you say, unfortunately,
on the front end.
You say politicians win by promising to build new things, even though it's the old things that need to be repaired. That might change, especially in Minnesota. You know, we're thinking after this, or, you know, memories are short. But what other factors are at work here? The political will won, and we've heard you loud and clear on that. But we're just wondering, a lot of these accidents seem to happen in summer. Does heat play a role?
Sure, temperature and climate plays a role. I mean, you're going to see the most extreme events take place in the extreme temperatures, hot or cold. We obviously don't know the very specific issues that led up to this particular collapse, but, you know, it could be extreme temperature. It could be extreme loading at a particular time. But, you know, you see water systems stressed in the summertime, and you see ice and so on in the wintertime. So those are the points in time when infrastructure are going to fail or at the extremes. Spring and fall are kind of the easy times.
Right. What else do you see as factors? Again, you know, we were talking with engineers from the area. There was construction going on. People have wondered. One eyewitness heard a jackhammer right before it started to buckle. But do you see anything? And again, you're from a great distance. But is there anything that's coming to mind for you?
No, and Robin, one of the problems is going to be that people are going to look for that one special thing that could have happened on that bridge so that they could feel better about driving across the bridge where I live in St. Louis. And in reality, if you look for that one special thing to make you feel better, what you're going to really miss is that the epidemic issue is just a lack of maintenance, and you're not going to see that. That's going to be prevalent everywhere, but not visible and obvious. And obviously, the politicians are good people, but they're going to look for that one thing that can categorize this as an accident, you know, a jackhammer that went left when it should have gone right, and things like that. But the real problem is always going to be we just haven't maintained these things for 10, 15 years.
Thomas Rooney, leading expert on infrastructure and president of In Situ Form Technologies in St. Louis, Missouri, speaking to us from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, where he's been working on a project. Thomas, we always appreciate your time on the program. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, a story will obviously continue to follow. But still ahead today, lessons from the Soviet pullout from Afghanistan that U.S. might use in Iraq. That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Last week, Defense Secretary Robert Gates confirmed that he is actively involved in drawing up contingency plans for exiting Iraq. Well, our next guest says the Pentagon might learn a few things by studying mistakes the Soviet Union made when it left Afghanistan after 10 years of bloody occupation. The Soviets first invaded in 1979. They began negotiations for withdrawal in 1982. But it was not until 1988 that they announced they would leave in 9 months. In fact, they planned to have reporters document the exit to highlight their goodwill. But it was a disaster. On the way out, Mujahideen rebels killed 500 Soviet troops. In some spots, fighting got so intense that the Soviet military had to airlift out of the country. The Soviets limped out of Afghanistan. But are Iraq and the Soviet Afghanistan comparable? Joining us from Fort Leavenworth, Texas, is Major Daniel Morgan. He's been researching the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1989. And Major Morgan, you've written a paper titled, Can We Iraqify the Problem? Consider the Soviet Lessons in Afghanistan. So give us the bottom line. In your opinion, what did the Soviets do wrong?
Well, initially, when they started the negotiations, once they began discussing possibilities of any withdrawal, increasing violence by both the Mujahideen and the Soviets began to occur. Where it got worse was the fact that the leadership in the Soviet Union continued to change. I mean, you have four different leaders in charge of the Soviet Union at the time, and they actually went from hardliners to conciliatory to hardliner to actual full withdrawal. Where it became a total failure, which is similar to now, is when Gorbachev announced a public timetable for withdrawal for 9 months and did not link it to the stability of the Kabul government.
In other words, he didn't link it to any preconditions.
No, there was no preconditions at all. There was no provisos. He said, we're just leaving in 9 months. It's that simple. And as a result, you had the Mujahideen immediately make an amnesty offer to the Afghan army, and the Afghan army immediately, large chunks of them, began defecting across over to the Mujahideen. You did not get a good, what we call, battle handover. And as a result, it created a huge military vacuum where the political vacuum was already weak as in of itself.
Well, let me ask you for a second, though. Did the Soviets really have any other alternative? Did they really have any negotiating power?
No, they didn't. And the difference is with us, and that's where the lesson is that we actually have that power. We actually have that capability. And there's no reason for us to announce a public timetable. We have the capability to be able to influence things inside of the Middle East, whether it be political or military. The Soviets were under a lot of other pressure because they were actually collapsing. That's one difference between these two. But the public timetable that they announced is what dramatically changed everything on the ground, because once that happened, you saw defections, you saw tribal sectarian alliances. So, for example, in Iraq, if the militias decide to offer amnesty to any organization in the Iraqi police or army to come over to them and they won't be, you know, tortured or killed, and we're not there to stop that, it's very plausible that that will happen.
How can you, given that there are so many actors and so many participants, it sounds as if you're saying that, you know, any talk of withdrawal almost has to be secret until there are some provisions that are hammered out. Does that sound realistic?
No, it doesn't. I don't think you can make it secret. I think everybody kind of recognizes the fact that the U.S. is going to withdraw to some degree. Whether that's going to be a zero-sum game or not is a decision for the policymakers. However, studies show, and also the evidence from the Soviet lessons, is that going from a publicly announced timeline or timetable in a withdrawal negotiations approach is all that's going to do is accelerate the violence in itself and just set the conditions for a full civil war. And that's why the recommendation based off of the studies is that we need to maintain probably a balance of power approach in the area based off of the Sunni and the Shia divide that we actually see in the area and the Iranian influence that's actually growing.
Tell us more about this balance of power approach. You write about regional players, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Jordan, Turkey, Iran, and then they all have a stake in Iraq. It sounds as if you're saying the U.S. should line up those players prior to any withdrawal.
Based off of the lessons from the Soviets, every actor here in the Middle East or state, such as Saudi Arabia, Syria, Jordan, Turkey, and Iran, all have a stake in Iraq. So in order to actually bring some stability and security to the region, you're looking at really three groups, but the main two groups are the Shia and the Sunni, and then you also have the Kurds up in the north with regards to Turkey. So bringing some stability to them as a region would balance the power so we don't have it start unraveling into a regional conflict.
You write that U.S. leaders should accept concessions with Iran and Syria to end the aiding of militias and movement of terrorists between Iraq and other countries. You say the U.S. cannot allow continued aid to resistance groups, as was done during the Soviet-Afghan conflict. And as you said, these resistance groups just pulled into the vacuum that was left after the Soviets announced they were leaving. It was the U.S. that was supporting the resistance groups during the Soviet-Afghan conflict. You know, but you're saying that they need to ask other countries not to do that, as the U.S. now plans a possible withdrawal.
Yeah, the irony in the situation, it's my point is, if you look at studies on counterinsurgencies and insurgency fights, if you are not effectively able to isolate external actors that are supporting an insurgency, if you're not able to isolate them and deny them infiltration of arms and other fighters into the country, you are going to have a really difficult time winning the fight. You know, completely.
Well, Major Daniel Morgan, again, having researched the Soviet Union failure in Afghanistan, you're saying that the lessons that can be learned by U.S. leaders today is to not set a withdrawal timetable without preconditions that can modify or reverse that withdrawal. But as you researched it, I'm wondering if you had the same feeling that some of our listeners might be having, which is that it may be too late. I mean, did you find the parallels to this point a little unnerving?
No, actually, I did not. I mean, I'm sure our society feels that it might be a little too late. However, if you look at the history of insurgencies and counterinsurgency, they take years, and they can succeed. And only nations can actually win them. If the nation decides to want to lose a war, they can obviously do that as well. But nations win wars, nations win conflicts, and it requires the time and the patience to do so.
Well, I guess that gets to my question, because a lot of people feel that the time has passed and they've run out of patience.
Well, yeah, and that's true, and that might be the case, and that's for our political leadership to decide. There's no question that we made some mistakes in decisions, strategic and operational and everything. However, you know, the enemy always has a vote, and some things don't go right, and sometimes we do make mistakes, even as America. But if we want to succeed and avoid a bloodbath, time is of the key essence, and announcing a public timetable will not be in our favor for the U.S. as well as the Iraqis that live in that country.
Major Daniel Morgan of the Command and General Staff College speaking to us from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. His paper is entitled, Can We Iraqify the Problem? Consider the Soviet Lessons in Afghanistan. Thanks so much for speaking to us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, before we go today, we're going to take a much-needed musical break with Linda Ronstadt. She's still coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. Okay, big trades in basketball, baseball, breaking records remains elusive for Barry, Tom, and A-Rod, and women who have been teed off, now tee off at St. Andrews. Here to talk about these stories and the rest of the week in sports, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Good to see you, Bill.
Good to be back.
And first, we have to take note of our, you know, top story of the day, you know, that bridge collapse in Minnesota. As you well know, many of the people on Interstate 35 West in Minnesota, when that bridge collapsed, were on their way to the Minnesota Twins game against the Kansas City Royals. And as we heard from one of our guests, somebody who went to the game, you know, the game, they kept the game going because what were they going to do with 25,000 people?
Well, that was the problem, of course. If those people had left the stadium, the traffic jam would have been that much worse. So it probably made a certain amount of sense.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was certainly on the minds. We're reading, you know, Twins reliever Pat Neshek, I think is the way he said his name. I mean, that's all they could think of while they were playing. Their friends were out there.
How could it have been otherwise? Right?
So that obviously had its impact, although, you know, not the most important part of a tragedy. And certainly, again, you know, not the most important thing, but Minnesota's also been thinking about this big trade. The NBA Timberwolves trading their all-star Kevin Garnett to the Boston Celtics.
Yes, more proof that you never stop being a Celtic when you're a Celtic. And so Kevin McHale, once a Celtic, of course, now in Minnesota in a managerial capacity, has helped the Celtics immeasurably by sending Kevin Garnett their
way. It feels that way, doesn't it?
Well, it does, partly because the Celtics, of course, have been so disappointing to people who follow them for such a relatively long time. And now people can look at that team and say, gee, they ought to be a lot better next year.
Well, I mean, I've got Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Ray Allen. Some are saying it's the best threesome in the league.
If the league suddenly goes to 3-on-3, they'll be in great shape.
Okay. Well, yep. Terrible time for Minnesotans, but a pretty good time, in fact, for the NBA. You have pointed out that, oh, my, that gambling scandal is sort of...
Yes, the referee who bet on games which he was officiating has been pushed into the background, at least in the minds of some serious NBA fans. I don't think that's going to go away. Commissioner Stern certainly hopes that people will now be thinking about which teams got better via trades, the Celtics among others, but this story's not going to go away, obviously.
This is referee Tim Donaghy allegedly betting on games he officiated during the last two seasons.
Right, and apparently, allegedly, also involved with figures in organized crime.
Right, letting them know which player might have a sprained ankle or something. Well, in baseball trades, Texas gave a slugging first baseman Mark Teixeira to the Atlanta Braves. In his debut, he hits a three-run homer to help beat the Houston Astros.
Good trade.
Yes, it would seem. also from Texas, the Boston Red Sox get all-star pitcher Eric Gagne to bolster what some would say is already a pretty good bullpen. And the Yankees dump pitcher Scott Proctor to make room on their staff for, I don't know, is it Yoba Chamberlain?
Mm-hmm.
And so good moves all?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you can't really judge a trade after one night, even if a guy hits a three-run homer and wins the game for you. But I think the most remarkable aspect of all this trading vis-a-vis the Yankees is that Mariano Rivera, their Hall of Fame-bound reliever, had said before the trade line, for goodness sake, get us some bullpen help out here, and none was forthcoming.
No.
So I think Red Sox fans probably feel pretty good about that.
Right. Well, meanwhile, and by the way, if you're just tuning in, our deep apologies. We are here in Boston, so it all seems to always come back to that. Meanwhile, Barry Bonds, one swing short of tying Hank Aaron's all-time home run record. You know, people have been now getting bleary-eyed, including the head of baseball. He's showing up at the games to follow
this. Yes, poor Commissioner Bud Selig has described his own task of following Barry Bonds' home run record pursuit as Herculean. Come on, Bud.
Oh, it's just
have a reality
it's a
check.
Home run.
You're going to ball games, for goodness sake.
And Alex Rodriguez is one short of reaching 500. Mets, he's with the Yankees, of course. Mets pitcher Tom Glavine still looking for his number 300 win. But I just want to touch on women. The Women's British Open underway today. For the first time, the ladies are going to tee off at the fabled old course at St. Andrews. What took so long?
I don't know. Barriers are meant to fall, and we should cheer when they fall, no matter how belatedly they fall, I suppose.
And some of, apparently, the early players in the game are there
canes and crutches.
But they,
no matter.
They have lived to see it.
Yep.
Bill Littlefield covers sports and more each week on NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks as always for
checking
with us. Still to come, the silky voice of Linda Ronstadt. That's after a minute break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the late 1970s, Linda Ronstadt was the pop star cover girl. She was featured 6 times on the cover of Rolling Stone. Her clear voice was a part of the soundtrack of a decade. In the 80s, she started singing songs that challenged her mind, her voice, and in some cases, her audience. She started putting out albums of the Mexican songs she grew up listening to in Arizona, big band collections, traditional country, and even Cajun music, seemingly unconcerned with those who followed her.
What's new? How is the world treating you?
Now at 61, she's on tour with a retrospective of her songs and a heavy dose of the classic American songbook. She is going to be appearing at the annual Newport Folk Festival and joins us now in advance of that. And welcome, Linda.
Well, thank you.
I'm wondering, there are some artists, they hear a song like You're No Good, and they want to run screaming from the room. What is that like when you hear something that is so beloved and such a hit, but you've heard so many times?
I run screaming from the room. I never listen to my stuff that I've recorded. It's just not wise.
Why? What's unwise about it?
First of all, I'm always sure I could have done a little better. And second of all, I think now, why would I ever want to sing that? You know, not that it's bad. It's just that it was for that time and that person that I was then. And I think that we're, you know, a series of editions of ourselves instead of one single person that just kind of is frozen.
And you've said, and I just read this somewhere, that you understand that the audience might hear those songs because you went to a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers concert, and at one point you wanted to hear them sing Refugee. Well, and they may not want to play Refugee.
Might want to do a song they just wrote, you know. I also, at some point during the 80s and the 90s, I started thinking that the songs that I grew up listening to were better songs for a singer, because they're written for a singer in mind. They're not written for a guitar player. I became very greedy for, especially the American Standard Songbook. You know, Gershwin, Robert Rogers and Hart, Irving Berlin, those guys really knew how to write for singers. And so that's the reason that those songs have been able to survive.
Let's listen to a little. We have your Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, a Rogers and Hart song.
I'm wild again, beguiled. Simpering, whimpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I.
Can you put your finger on what it is that makes it so much deeper and more sophisticated?
Well, you know, it's just, you had a lot of different migrations coming. You had the African migration a couple hundred years ago, and so they brought this kind of rhythm that became the underpinning for jazz, which is 5-beat. And then you had Scotch-Irish sort of music hall, corny, you know, sentimental songs. And then you had another migration, the Jewish migration from Central Europe, and is highly literate with a lot of, connection to European musical forms like the orchestra. You know, a song like Bewitched held one meaning for me when I was in my 30s. It's totally different. I'm 61 now, and I can still sing that song. It still resonates to my life, but it's all different stories now. Yeah. So it's a cumulative thing.
Well, and, you know, and obviously you're singing a lot more of this Great American Songbook as you do your concerts, but I just want to just jump in and ask a question. You know, where does Jimmy Webb fit into all of this? Because I would say, you know, two of my favorites of your songs are Adios and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Oh, they're my favorites, too. I mean, he's brilliant. You know, Jimmy is one of the few second half of the 20th century songwriters that I think writes, you know, that level of craft and that level of musicianship. It's really a complex thing that he writes. Those are finely, finely crafted songs. The only other people that I can think of write it, you know, right off the bat are Randy Newman and Paul Simon. You know, there are others, too, but there aren't a lot, whereas in the first half of the century, there were plenty. So it changed. You know, in the first half of the century, we had good songs, and the second half of the century, we had good, really good records. The emphasis was more to recording what kind of sound you'd get, and, you know, it was a one-off kind of thing.
Well, it just gives me an excuse to hear both of them again.
Well, good.
So let's do that.
Adios. radio. Once the sun did shine, and Lord, it felt so fine.
You know, I want to ask you, Linda Ronstadt, what's your relationship with someone like a Jimmy Webb? We actually, he performed here at a small club in the Boston area, and he sang his songs, and he spoke of you as a muse, but also there's sort of an edge, you know, as if there was some sort of, just sort of a rubbing together of your mind and his when a song came
it's
out.
It's an odd thing. I don't know what it is. I just love Jimmy. I love everything he does. The way the chords of voice always have a very disturbing impact on me. Like, they make me kind of sick to my stomach, you know, in a good way. I mean, they make me aware that there are emotions that I have that I've been stuffing down, and I can't... Mm-hmm. I can't deny them anymore, and they simply have to come out. I have to acknowledge them. And that's the job of a really good songwriter. I used to feel the same way about Rosemary Clooney. Rosemary would sing some song that I'd heard a million times, and when she'd sing it, I go, my God, I didn't know that song meant that. When Jimmy starts to play those first opening chords, I go, oh, my God, I didn't realize I was so sad and I've been holding it in, you know, and I just want to burst into tears. It's a strange ability that he has, and that's what a really good songwriter does. It's not just the melody and the lyrics. It's how the chords are voiced and how they move from this chord to that chord that have a really profound impact on us emotionally. There's a real biological resonance with music.
Hearing you speak, I remember reading somewhere that at one point you were reading The Unbearable Lightness of Being about the invasion of Czechoslovakia, and that book sort of, you could feel that book all over whatever album you were recording
at
the time.
I remember the song was Round Midnight. It made me think about the Czech invasion, you know, which I'm sure the guy that wrote Round Midnight wasn't thinking it at all about Czechoslovakia, but it seemed like a profound, sad, disturbed thing that you worry about in the middle of the night. You know, I wake up in the middle of the night right now and wonder what my government's doing. Cultures change fast. So that's what that song to me was about. To somebody else, it would be, you know, my boyfriend left me. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, especially given what you think about, I'm just wondering, you know, if the old life, the cover of Rolling Stone, speculation about who's Linda dating, Jerry Brown, Mick Jagger, you know, if that just maybe got boring.
Well, it was silly. And as I almost never showed up in public, you know, in galas or... you know, openings for movies or anything like that. I just didn't. So a lot of that was just generated, and eventually they just got tired of it. And also, I aged out of it, you know. Who cares? I'm 61, you know.
How does that feel for you? What would you
well,
say
from
that?
It feels like my knees hurt, you know, but other than that, you know, I still think about the same things that I thought about.
Is it freeing?
It's freeing in a lot of ways. Like, for instance, I don't look like I did when I was in my 30s, so I'm seldom recognized on the street now. That is a wonderful thing. Because when you walk into a room, if people are looking at you, you've lost your ability to observe them.
Do you think your voice is richer? How would you describe age and voice?
Is it richer? No, I don't think it's richer. No. I think it's different. But, you know, it won't last forever. I mean, at some point, I'll stop singing.
My hand just went to my heart.
Well, you're so sweet. You know, it's a meat instrument, and it doesn't stay the same. It's not like picking up your saxophone, which is always made out of metal, although there is that reed in your lip. You know, it's hard to keep that. As you get older, it gets harder.
Well, catch her while you can. Linda Ronstadt, on tour this summer with a stop at the Newport Folk Festival this weekend. Some dates with Jimmy Webb. Very exciting. For more on all of this, go to our website, here-now.org. Linda, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
I'll never forget you. I'll never forget you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
I'll never forget how we promised one day to love one another. Forever.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.